at speech every time, almost to the word. But the best part, from his point of view, was the time he got to spend in private, recruiting precinct captains and other activists for his wife, getting a handle on how the process worked, drilling down with Teresa Villemain, the top-drawer organizer whom Hillary had just signed on to run the state for her. On the flight home, Hillary was uncertain how the trip had gone. She was hoarse and exhausted, worried about the press's parsing of her and Bill's body language, the criticisms that they'd been too programmed. Bill tried to buck her up. "You did great," he said. "You really touched people. The crowds were hanging on your every word." But, in truth, Iowa was starting to plague Bill's mind. The campaign's local advisors had told him in no uncertain terms that the one thing Iowans wouldn't abide was negative campaigning, which meant it would be hard to take Obama down in the manner that Bill and Penn thought necessary. After the Henry memo, there was no getting out of Iowa for Hillary, and yet, after all the work she'd done there, she was still struggling as in no other state. Bill Clinton wondered if Iowa was laying a triple whammy on his wife. She couldn't attack, she couldn't quit, and she couldn't win. And yet, for all that had happened so far in 2007, for all the turbulence and doubts, for all the internal squabbles and external missteps, Hillary publicly didn't appear to be a beleaguered figure as the summer turned to fall. She didn't feel that way either. While there was cause for disquiet, there were plenty of reasons for confidence. She had entered the year the frontrunner, and she was still the frontrunner, now more than ever. And Obama seemed to be fading, just as she had predicted. She had whipped him in the interminable series of Democratic debates that had taken place since April. Her mastery of the issues, her knowledge of every jot and tittle about every aspect of public policy had been on full display, and Obama had been exposed for the naif she knew he was, coming across as vague and weak and windy. With Penn's help, she had neutralized many of her most glaring vulnerabilities. She had blurred the distinctions between her and Obama on Iraq, adroitly changing the subject from which candidate was most anti-war to who was more qualified to bring the conflict to an end. She had recast her awful history with health care reform, unveiling her long-awaited plan in mid-September, and getting rave reviews for her substantive prowess, the detail and clarity of her presentation, and her self-deprecating allusions to her disastrous attempt to overhaul the system as First Lady. She'd watched as Obama's campaign was hammered for producing a proposal that was an obvious ripoff of hers. She'd begun to diffuse her rival's message, giving speeches where she said, "Change is just a word without the strength and experience to make it happen." And finally, in the third quarter of the year, she had succeeded in raising more money than Obama. All along, Clinton had held a commanding lead over Obama in the national polls. Now, on October 3rd, came a new ABC News Washington Post survey that seemed to shift the appropriate description from clear frontrunner to prohibitive favorite. The poll put Hillary ahead of Obama by a staggering 33-point margin, 53-20. Despite all the efforts of her opponents to tar her as too polarizing to be electable, the poll found that 57% of voters rated her the most likely of the Democratic candidates to win in the fall. More heartening still, not only was Clinton leading decisively among voters who were looking for strength and experience, but she was beating Obama 45-31 among those seeking new direction and new ideas. The poll was the talk of the political world. Even in Iowa, the race seemed to be tilting in her favor. Thanks in large part to Villemain's labors, Hillary was now in a virtual three-way tie in the state. 2 weeks later, Hillary received a piece of news that thrilled her beyond measure. She was getting the endorsement of Georgia Congressman John Lewis. Lewis was one of the civil rights era's greatest heroes, an African-American student organizer beaten nearly to death by a white mob during the Freedom Rides of 1961. All year long, despite Hillary's aversion to buttonholing superdelegates, elected officials and other party honchos who would vote automatically at the national convention the next summer in Denver, their endorsements kept falling into her lap, while Obama collected virtually none. But Lewis was a particularly welcome feather in her cap and a harsh blow to Obama. What all this said to Hillary was that the natural order was reasserting itself. Despite the angst of the past 10 months, the elements of Penn's plan were falling into place. The money, the establishment support, the muscle to win. She was showing Obama, as Penn wrote in his December memo, how it is really done. And the press corps, for all its disdain for her, was coming around to the opinion that the campaign had sought to instill from the start. Hillary's victory was inevitable. And she seemed to believe it, too. How confident was Clinton? So self-certain that she began to turn her attention to a question no rational candidate would have dared to contemplate this early. Who should be her running mate in the general election? She had already determined without a sliver of doubt that she was not going to choose Obama. She knew she would come under enormous pressure to do so from all corners of the party and the press, and she had already come up with a solution. Clinton decided she needed to have a prominent African-American or two to run her vice presidential search process. She was inclined to tap Cheryl Mills and Vernon Jordan, a longtime friend of the Clintons and Washington's premier black power broker. When her aides asked who would be at the top of her VP shortlist, she mentioned Biden, Vilsack, and Ohio Governor Ted Strickland. But Clinton was getting even further ahead of herself than that. One day that fall, she summoned her friend Roger Altman to meet with her in Washington. Altman was a major Wall Street player who had served as deputy treasury secretary in the Clinton administration. As they sat in her basement hideaway office in the Capitol, Hillary asked Altman to undertake a secret project on her behalf. She wanted him to start planning for her transition to the White House after she won the general election. "I don't want to get to the point," she said, "where the election comes and we're scrambling to do a transition. I want to be in the opposite position." Altman already knew what Clinton was going to ask him to do. A few days earlier, he'd had a call from John Podesta, who told him that Hillary wanted them together to undertake the transition effort. For about half an hour, Altman and Clinton discussed how the plan would work, setting up a schedule for the next few months and focusing on the selection of chairs and co-chairs to run the preparation on a variety of issues. Hillary made clear how important it was that the word of the endeavor not leak. She had devised a cover story that the Altman-Podesta-led meetings were merely part of a project on presidential transitions already underway at Podesta's Center for American Progress. At the Clinton campaign headquarters in Ballston, Virginia, just a few minutes outside Washington, the few aides who were aware of the transition preparations were alarmed by the whole scheme, by the presumptuousness of it, and even more by the risks involved. If news broke that Hillary had already started working on her presidential transition, the ensuing media maelstrom would be crippling, undermining the campaign's efforts to tamp down the perception of Clinton's arrogance and sense of entitlement. Altman and Podesta, for their part, believed the undertaking was just another sign of Clinton's methodical commitment to preparation. "She's such a planner," Altman thought, but they were spooked by the notion that Hillary might be jinxing herself. "Let's hope this isn't the bell that tolls the finale for the campaign," they joked. One night in October, as Clinton flew back east from a campaign stop in Arizona, she cracked open a bottle of white wine and kicked around the latest media offer on the table, a cover shoot and accompanying inside photo spread in Vogue. Anna Wintour, the magazine's glamorous editrix, and her people were wheedling the campaign. "It will be good for Hillary," they said. "Great photos. The first woman president in waiting. She should do it." Clinton's aides thought it was a fabulous idea, another opportunity to humanize their boss, but Clinton was skeptical. "I don't think a Vogue photo shoot is going to be helpful," Hillary said. "I'm still trying to convince white men that I can be the commander-in-chief, and me looking pretty in a dress isn't going to do that." Hillary took a sip of wine and let her mind drift toward the future. "You realize," she said to her aides, "we're only Iowa away from winning this?" Chapter 6. Barack in a Box. Obama walked into the 8th-floor conference room in the downtown Washington offices of Perkins Coie, the law firm where his attorney Bob Bauer was a partner. It was February 2007, and the room was filled with expectant faces, some familiar and some new to him. The team of pollsters, image makers, and consultants assembled at lightning speed by Axelrod and Plouffe to help Obama reach the White House. They were seated around a big rectangular table, a dozen of them. "Whoa," said Obama, looking around the room. "Am I paying all you people?" The group was replete with top-flight national political talent, although few of them resided in the Capitol. They came from Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sioux Falls. Almost all were men, almost all were white. They would play a large role in shaping Obama's destiny over the next 20 months, but it was the first time they'd all been together in the same space. It would also be the last. Obama sat down and listened as David Binder, the focus group impresario from San Francisco, ran through the results of the sessions he'd recently conducted in the first four states, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina. To the voters he sampled, Obama was an unknown quantity, Binder said, but their first impressions were positive. When Binder showed them video of Obama, they were struck by his sincerity, his genuineness, his not-the-same-old-same-old politicianness. They loved his convention keynote, of course, and were also impressed by the prescience of his 2002 speech in opposition to the Iraq War. Obama's lead pollster, Joel Benenson, presented the findings of surveys he had done in New Hampshire, and these, too, were encouraging. Obama was only 4 points behind Hillary in a state in which the Clintons had a reservoir of goodwill, and among voters following the race closely, he actually had a 10-point lead. The numbers showed that although Hillary was popular with Democrats, there seemed to be a ceiling on her support. The party's anti-war wing was suspicious of her. Others questioned whether her duties as First Lady should count as a qualification for the presidency. Most important, voters were looking for change over experience by a 2-to-1 margin, and even rock-ribbed partisans craved a candidate who could move the country past the bitter polarization of the previous 15 years, with which Hillary and Bill was strongly identified. Obama took it all in with a mixture of interest and amusement, asking questions occasionally, but not obsessively. The thing that jumped out at him, however, involved Benenson's analysis of the change versus experience dynamic. "I gotta believe Hillary has people just as smart as our team all around her," Obama said. "Aren't they going to realize this and try to take our message?" "You know, Barack," David Axelrod cut in, "Joel used to work for Mark Pence, so he knows him pretty well." "I do know him pretty well," Benenson said. "I know his blind spots. He believes that you play to your strengths and not your weaknesses." Benenson and Axelrod detested Penn. They thought he represented the dark side of the business. To them, he was a money-crazed mercenary, an arrogant prick, a thug whose chief claim to fame was Bill Clinton's 1996 re-election, in which there was no nomination contest. Benenson told Obama that Penn would resist shifting strategy with every fiber of his being. "He'll just keep plowing down the same path," the pollster said, "because he wants so desperately to be right from the beginning." Obama nodded, but he was wary of any explanation so rooted in psychobabble. He wondered if they could really count on the obstinacy of Hillary's chief strategist to keep pushing her down the road to ruin. He found the depth of Axelrod's antipathy for Penn slightly inexplicable, but kind of funny. A few weeks later, when Obama's message maestro called to recount in copious and animated detail the Harvard event at which Penn had tried to undermine Obama's anti-war cred, Barack laughed and said, "You really don't like that guy, do you?" But Obama had enormous faith in Axelrod's judgment and intuitions, a faith that had served him well since they'd become politically entwined nearly 15 years earlier. He also had faith in the early state strategy that Axelrod and Plouffe had laid out before he decided to enter the race. At another meeting that February in Washington, this time with a handful of his African-American advisors, Obama was confronted with their concerns. Some in the press had questioned whether he was black enough to appeal to voters of color. In terms of personal identity, he said, "This is very painful for me." But the questions would fade as a campaign issue as black voters became better acquainted with him. And besides, the issue was more or less irrelevant to the larger construct of the race. "Hillary is running on inevitability, and if we win Iowa, that's gone, and this is ours," Obama said firmly. "We'll be able to wrap it up in a month." For a novice presidential candidate who launched his bid with virtually no concrete preparation, Obama's brio and self-assurance at the start were otherworldly. Everything that happened in the campaign's first few weeks fed his sense of confidence. From the announcement speech in Springfield, he flew to Iowa on a chartered Boeing 757 with his wife, daughters, and 57 reporters in tow. 2,000 people showed up for his first town hall meeting in Cedar Rapids. The next day, 7,000 at the Iowa State University basketball arena in Ames. 2 weeks later, 20,000 at an outdoor rally in Austin, Texas, standing and cheering in the rain. The crowds confirmed Obama's basic instinct. The country really is hungry for something fresh and new, he thought, and he was it. But it wasn't just the crowds that amped him up. There was also the money. Penny Pritzker, his national finance chair, had him running flat out, his schedule crammed with back-to-back fundraising events, sometimes six or seven in a day, and his call sheet was even denser. Obama didn't relish pleading for cash any more than Clinton did, but he wasn't going to do it half-assed. He did what he had to do, and he was good at it. He knew how to work an elite room, how to come off as, well, the un-Clinton, in front of big donors who were seeking an alternative to the front-runner. Take Orrin Kramer, one of the New York financial titans Obama had met with in December. Kramer was a Clinton stalwart who'd raised millions of dollars for Gore and Kerry as well. Hillary Land was working him hard, dispatching Penn to call him and make the sale. But when Kramer told Penn that he thought 2008 was going to be a change election, which would pose problems for Hillary, Penn was airily dismissive. Obama, by contrast, didn't outsource his pitch. He neither dissed the hedge fund kingpin nor sucked up to him. Rather, he talked to him in person, over a meal, and calmly and cogently laid out his theory of the case. And he waxed lyrical about how his operation planned to use the web in transformational ways for both fundraising and organizing. The riff on connectivity baffled Kramer, but it enhanced his perception of Obama as an avatar of the future. And by the end of the dinner, he was on board. Still, Obama was as shocked as anyone when his fundraising team more than doubled its goal and beat Clinton in the first quarter. The web had almost nothing to do with it. That electronic gold mine would be tapped only much later. Instead, it had everything to do with big-time bundlers such as Kramer and other Wall Street players such as Soros and Robert Wolf, Hollywood types such as Geffen and Edgar Bronfman, African-American music barons such as Andre Harrell and L.A. Reid, as well as a new generation of baby bundlers who were looking for a seat at the table, but believed that in the House of Clinton all the chairs were already taken. Obama watched as his fundraising success fueled a virtuous circle. Money plus big crowds equaled glowing press, which in turn equaled bigger crowds and even more money. Out in Iowa, Hildebrand and his partner Paul Tews were opening field offices, recruiting precinct captains, training volunteers. In the Chicago headquarters, the campaign hired a pair of internet aficionados, one a veteran of Howard Dean's pathbreaking online operation in 2004, the other a technologist who had worked at the travel site Orbitz to build a state-of-the-art web presence with links to Facebook and YouTube. Every day, Obama talked to Plouffe, getting updates on the progress they were making on all fronts, and every day, what he heard said one thing to him. This is real. Inside Obama's campaign, the reigning metaphor for what they were doing was taking off in a jet airplane while they were still bolting on the wings. And in a few short weeks, Air Obama was soaring in the sky. But attaining such altitude so fast brought with it great expectations and close scrutiny, which was about to reveal that Obama's weaknesses as a candidate were every bit as great as his strengths. The first signs of trouble came in quick succession in the last week of March. Out in Las Vegas, Obama took part in the campaign's first issue-specific forum. The topic was health care, and watched from the wings as Clinton knocked the cover off the ball. She was sharp, passionate, and detailed. The crowd ate it up. Obama, for his part, was only casually prepared, assuming he could wing it. "It'll be like when I'm on Charlie Rose," he thought. It wasn't. Vague and platitudinous, mouthing generalities and making excuses for not having his health care plan in order, Obama came across as amateurish. The union audience was both surprised and mildly offended. Back on the plane afterward, Obama was glum and seemed slightly intimidated by Clinton. "She was terrific," he said to Gibbs. "I was not." 4 days later, in Washington, Obama spoke at the annual legislative conference of the Building and Construction Trades Department, appearing last after all the other Democratic presidential candidates. He was flat, listless, uninspiring. He thought he bombed. Back in his Senate office, he spotted Gibbs and asked him to take a walk. "I don't know what's going on," Obama said as they made their way to the Capitol, where he had to cast a vote. Nothing was clicking, he said. He wasn't finding his rhythm. He couldn't understand why. He felt like he was alone in the middle of the ocean without a raft. Gibbs listened intently, attempted to offer consolation, but nothing he said helped. He thought it was the saddest he'd ever seen Obama. Thus began a spring and summer of misery for the candidate. He'd been warned how hard this was going to be, but he had silently scoffed. And for the first few weeks, it hadn't been hard at all. It had been a rush. But now, the initial adrenaline surge was wearing off, and Obama was facing the wretchedness of the reality he'd signed up for. It wasn't long before Axelrod and Plouffe wondered if he was nurturing second thoughts about his decision to run. The schedule was killing him. The fatigue was all-consuming. The events piled up on top of one another, making his temples ache. He tried not to bitch and moan too much, except when it got out of hand, meaning almost every day. Once, at 5 in the afternoon on the bus in Iowa, he turned to his body guy, Reggie Love, and asked, "How many more things do I have today?" "Reggie, 3. "Barack, are you kidding me?" What made it all the worse was the books, always with the books, these people desperate for a signature. So many nights on the trail, after his final event of the day, with Obama wanting nothing more than to get back to his hotel and hit the sheets, he'd find them stacked up in the holding room, 50, 100, 150 copies of Audacity or Dreams, waiting his John Hancock. He'd look at the pile, shake his head, then wearily pick up his pen. Obamamania had its costs. This was one of them. The loss of privacy, of control over his life, was another. On that Austin trip back in February, he was mobbed at the airport when he tried to catch a Southwest flight to Chicago. He could no longer fly commercial. He often joked ruefully that his life was now controlled by the 22-year-olds who planned his days. Then there was the Secret Service, which began watching over him in May. Man, how he chafed at that. Not long after his protection started, he returned to Chicago from New Orleans looking forward to a haircut. The service guy said, "Sure, but we've got to case the place first." "Why can't I just go to my barber?" Obama groaned. "I've been going to him for years." The staff, on the other hand, adored the service. They helped keep the perennially late Obama on schedule. He didn't like to make the agents wait around for him. Most of all, he missed his girls, all 3 of them. Every time they came out on the trail with him, he was a different man. He laughed, for one thing, smiled, for another, didn't gripe so much, but they were hardly ever there. Michelle saw to that. She told the staff she would be on the road only 1 day a week, and that was that. She assented to abbreviated day trips to Iowa sometimes, but she always insisted on being back by nightfall, and she was rarely with Barack. The debates made her queasy, so she stayed away from all but one of them. And at that one, she turned to Jarrett and said, "Do you think anyone would notice if we leave in the middle?" In the late spring, Axelrod, Plouffe, and Rouse took Obama out to dinner in D.C. He had been complaining in front of the staff more than usual, so they decided to give him a chance to vent. A few minutes into the meal, Obama caught the drift and said, "Okay, is this an intervention?" None of it would have been so bad if he had been performing up to snuff, but he wasn't, and he knew it, and it pained him. Of all the things he'd questioned when he was mulling the race, the one he never doustedwas that he would be terrific on the hustings. His whole life he had been a star, able to switch on the juice at a moment's notice, impressive, charming, and memorable. Feelings of inadequacy had therefore never been a big part of the Obama psychic profile, but when it came to playing the role of a presidential candidate, he was experiencing them all the time. At town hall meetings, he tried to treat voters with respect by giving them adult, soundbite-free answers, but he was coming across as professorial and pedantic, taking 10 minutes to respond to the simplest queries. The memory of his convention keynote had his audiences anticipating a kind of uplift. "People are expecting to come crying out of every speech I give," he told Gibbs. That was impossible for him to provide day after day. After he'd riffed for months on his announcement address, his stump speech was flabby and overlong. He could feel that he wasn't connecting. The debates were even worse, in no small part because he was suffering mightily by comparison to Clinton, who was just so much better than he or anyone around him had ever imagined she would be, always on message, always in control, her mastery of bullet points and talking points solid, her style an admixture of unexpected breeziness and earnest sapience. And he had a bad habit of handing Hillary a stick with which to thump him. At the first Democratic debate that April in Orangeburg, South Carolina, NBC's Brian Williams asked Obama how he would change the nation's military stance if America were hit again with 2 simultaneous attacks by Al-Qaeda. "Well, the first thing we'd have to do is make sure that we've got an effective emergency response," Obama replied, slowly winding his way to potentially taking some action to dismantle that network. Clinton's answer mentioned retaliation within 10 seconds. In the debate spin room later, her team pounded on Obama for his limp-wristedness. Obama had a lot to say and wasn't good at spitting it out quickly or concisely, tending to back into his responses. Rather than sell one idea well, he tried to squeeze in as many points as possible. "I have 60 seconds," he said in prep. "How much do you guys think I can get into 60 seconds?" When Axelrod showed him video of the debates, he grimaced. "It's worse than I thought," ran through his mind. He pledged to do better. "I need to figure out how to get this right," he said. But as the debates went along and he continued to founder, Obama's frustration mounted. He started showing up late for prep sessions or cutting them short, or spending the whole time on his BlackBerry, or finding excuses to avoid them altogether. "You guys don't have this together," he said once. "I'm going to take a nap." The superficial way the debates were scored by the press corps annoyed him no end. At the CNN YouTube debate in Charleston, South Carolina that summer, a questioner asked if Obama would be willing to meet separately without precondition with the leaders of Iran, Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, and North Korea in order to bridge the gap that divides our countries? Obama didn't flinch. "I would. And the reason is this, that the notion that somehow not talking to countries is punishment to them, which has been the guiding diplomatic principle of the Bush administration, is ridiculous." Hillary's post-debate spinners called his answer irresponsible and naive. Even some of Obama's own team thought he should walk it back. The next morning, Obama made a surprise appearance on a staff conference call and declared, "I want to be clear. I said what I meant, and I believe it. We should go on offense here, because what Hillary is saying is she wants to do what Bush and Cheney do. It's the sort of Washington conventional wisdom that I hate." Obama believed that he was right on the substance and on the politics, but the conventional wisdom mongers in the media bludgeoned him for weeks, swallowing the Clinton line, slamming him for dropping the ball again on a national security question. The debates fed a narrative that was becoming pervasive in the press. Edwards was running on bold ideas, universal health care, a new war on poverty. Hillary was the mistress of the nitty-gritty. And Obama was a lightweight, all sizzle and no steak. This is what the media did. It put every candidate in a neat little box and slapped a pithy label on it. Obama understood. But for the past 3 years, as the press fawned over him, the box he was stuffed into bore a succession of tags that were flattering and advantageous. New, fresh, inspiring, post-racial. He'd never had a negative run of press on the national level, and therefore never developed the kind of thick protective hide that repelled the media's slings and arrows. What made it worse was that Obama knew he'd helped build this box himself, that he'd left himself open to and even invited the charges of insubstantiality that were bedeviling him. He had signed on to the strategy of stressing thematics over specifics, on the grounds that waging a battle with Clinton on the policy margins would pay paltry dividends. But now, he was having his doubts. He wanted to be seen as substantive. He was substantive. And not being viewed that way was hurting his chances, he thought. "I've spent my whole life caring about policy," he told his staff. "I want to have new ideas. I want them to be specific. I want to make sure that no one can say they're not specific enough." Obama had imagined at the outset of the campaign that he would set aside hours to consult with world-class experts, delving into the issues, devising innovative solutions. He kept asking for more time to do that, but his schedule was too jam-packed with fundraisers and campaign events. All he was doing was reading memos from his policy shop and getting pummeled by the press for being a cipher. The media was in his head on this topic for sure, but there were other voices in there too and other causes for concern. Michelle was worried about the national polls. "Why aren't we moving?" she kept asking. She feared that the campaign, with its monomania about Iowa, was failing to build a broad base of support across the map. It struck her that the campaign's post-racial demeanor, while politically expedient, was neglecting one of the central motivations that had driven Barack to enter the race. More than anything, it bothered her that her husband was losing, and that he seemed disconsolate in the bargain. Michelle's disgruntlement was echoed in Obama's ears by another source, one from outside the bubble that enveloped him. For months, he had been swapping emails with his former law school professor, Chris Edley, sharing his myriad dissatisfactions with how things were going. Edley had worked in the Carter and Clinton White Houses and been issues director on the Dukakis presidential campaign. Even from the remove of the deanship of Berkeley's law school, Edley had strong views about what caused presidential campaigns to fail, and he was stoking Obama's fear that his bid was headed in that direction. The candidate decided it was time to stage an intervention of his own. In mid-July, Obama let Plouffe know he wanted to set aside a few hours for a meeting of the senior staff. Everyone was aware that Obama wasn't happy, so they braced for an unpleasant evening. At 7:30 on the appointed night, the extended Obama Brain Trust, Axelrod, Plouffe, Gibbs, Hildebrand, Mastro Monaco, Pritzker, Jarrett, Nesbitt, communications aide Dan Pfeiffer, a few others, and Michelle, convened at Jarrett's Chicago apartment where they were joined by Edley. To everyone in the room besides the candidate's wife, the dean was a stranger. Obama had invited Edley to the meeting without giving him any instructions as to what his input should be. It was a halfway to Iowa review, Obama said, and that was all. Now Edley was sitting there between Michelle and Jarrett, directly opposite Obama, with everyone crowded around the giant oval table in Jarrett's dining room. After listening to the candidate's opening remarks, "We've come a long way, we have a long way to go, there are things we need to do better," the dean unloaded. "You people," Edley said, referring to Master Monaco, the scheduler, and Juliana Smoot, the chief fundraiser, "are being too relentless, too greedy for Barack's time. He's being overprogrammed, overscheduled, treated like a standard-issue candidate, when nothing could be further from the truth. This is a guy who likes to think, he likes to write, he likes to talk with experts," Edley said. "You folks have got to recognize what he's in this for. He's in this because he wants to make contributions in terms of public policy ideas, and you've got to make time for him to do that." Edley wasn't speaking calmly. He was all riled up. He believed that the campaign was putting at risk the whole point of Obama's candidacy, and he was certain that Obama felt the same because Obama had told him so. "With all due respect to all you here," he said, nodding toward Axelrod and Plouffe, "you should just get over yourselves and do what the candidate wants." Around the table, the members of Team Obama either stared straight down or shot daggers at Edley. Quietly, the room seethed. "With all due respect," thought Gibbs. "Who the hell are you to come in here and tell us, with all due respect?" But Edley was far from done. The policy work at the campaign was perfunctory, he said, just laundry lists of mediocre stuff. They needed to develop some conceptually ambitious, frame-breaking proposals rooted in Obama's personality and values, and then integrate those ideas thoroughly into his message, Edley said. Axelrod, bristling with resentment, spoke up in defense of the campaign. "We do spend time with him on policy," he protested, citing a focus group they had recently conducted in Michigan. Edley's jaw nearly hit the table. "A focus group isn't policymaking," he said derisively. Edley raised the question of constituency politics, suggesting that the Obama team's obsessive focus on Iowa was causing them to pay too little attention to minorities, and that the campaign was blowing off women because of Clinton's strength among female voters, both dangerous games politically that could create problems long term. Obama wasn't wavering on the early state strategy and its focus on Iowa, though. "I think it's the right strategy," he said. "I think it's the only strategy, and I don't think we should change it." But he was bothered by Clinton's lead with black voters. "They don't want to be taken for granted," Obama said, noting that he didn't appreciate the carping of the African-American leadership, with its claims that he was trying to downplay his blackness. "And I don't think we can concede women to Clinton, even though she's going to win the majority of them," he added. The meeting lasted for more than 3 hours, covering many topics, but it was the impression left by Edley that lingered. In the eyes of the Obama staff, and especially Axelrod, Plouffe, and Gibbs, his words were counterproductive. They fueled Obama's fixation on policy, which the political professionals considered a distraction from the real tasks at hand, and Edley's demeanor was worse than that. The Obamans viewed him as an obnoxious ass and prayed they'd never see his face again. But not everyone in the room shared that assessment, even though, looking back on it later, Edley himself would acknowledge his insufferableness. All throughout his comments, Michelle and Jarrett were conspicuously nodding their heads. Obama's campaign, from the start, had been controlled with an iron grip by the troika of Axelrod, Plouffe, and Gibbs, the Suits, as they were nicknamed internally by those wary of their degree of power. Over the previous few months, as Obama's distress grew, Michelle and Valerie had come to see the suits as forming a circle around Barack that was too tight and too resistant to dissenting opinions for his own good. They were thrilled to have an outsider at the table and avidly absorbed what Edley was saying. He's channeling Barack, thought Jarrett. Obama's own feelings about the Edley intercession were opaque, however, in the moment, at least. He neither supported his friend's fiercest contentions nor defended Axelrod and Plouffe when Edley laid into them. He refused to show his hand even privately to the dean, who never heard a word from Obama about the meeting. But after Edley returned to Berkeley, he did hear from Jarrett. You were terrific, she told him, fiery and provocative, the perfect foil. What did Barack think? Edley asked. You played exactly the role he wanted you to play, she said. A month later, at the end of August, the Obamas made their usual summer sojourn to Martha's Vineyard. Nothing about Barack's political fortunes had brightened in the time since the Edley meeting. If anything, they had darkened. A few weeks earlier, he had given a speech advocating military strikes under certain circumstances against terrorist targets in Pakistan, and been whacked again for an alleged gaffe by the Clinton campaign and the foreign policy panjandrums. The national polls were stuck stubbornly in place. Obama trailed Clinton by some 20 points, and the situation in be-all and end-all Iowa was hardly cheerier. For all the time and money the campaign had poured into the state, Obama had put no distance between himself and Hillary or Edwards. Among Obama's donors, Sturm and Drang was the order of the day. Having sunk more than $50 million into Obama, they were jittery about the possibility that they had thrown good money after a bad candidate. Frantic calls and emails were flooding into Pritzker, complaining about Obama, his advisors, and their strategy, offering theories on how to fix all three, the loudest of which was that Obama needed to go negative on Clinton. Much of Washington agreed. Chuck Schumer was up in arms, telling fellow senators that Obama needed to take a 2x4 to Clinton, prophesying that his reluctance to do so indicated that he wasn't tough enough to win. Claire McCaskill was serving as a back channel to Obama for the whispering conspirators, those Democratic senators privately rooting for him but afraid to cross the Clintons. Tell Barack this, they would say to her, and then advise that he take out his truncheon. He has to go after her, they said. There's so much there. He has to do to her now what the Republicans will do to her in the fall, or at least remind Democrats what's in store for us if she wins the nomination. McCaskill dutifully took the messages to Obama. It won't work, he said. It's not what this campaign is. And besides, Obama added, we're going to win Iowa. You know, Barack, McCaskill replied, every candidate running for president says they're going to win Iowa. I know, said Obama. A long pause. We're going to win Iowa. Up on the vineyard, though, as he and his family luxuriated in 8 days of bike rides and beachcombing at a house in Oak Bluffs with Jarrett, the Nesbitts, and the family of another close friend from Chicago, Eric Whitaker, Obama brooded and pondered. He still had faith in his strategy, his team, and himself, but he knew the time was fast approaching in which his campaign would have to step up its game, and more to the point, he would have to step up his game. His staff might have thought the Edley meeting was just a passive-aggressive tactic on Obama's part, a way for him to let off steam by proxy, but for Obama, it was the moment when he began to take control of his campaign. Obama had long talks on the vineyard with Jarrett and Rouse, who happened to be vacationing there too, about how the operation had to change. He trusted Axelrod, Plouffe, and Gibbs, and preferred to deal with as few people as possible. The campaign may have been pushing bottom-up democracy, but he was a top-down guy. Yet Obama had come to agree with Michelle and Jarrett that the innermost circle needed to be broadened beyond the suits. He asked Rouse, who was still living in Washington, to start commuting to Chicago so he could have a more active hand at headquarters. And he asked Jarrett, whose role had been informal until then, to join the campaign full-time. Bringing Valerie on board was no small thing. Her relationship with both Barack and Michelle transcended politics. They had all known one another since 1991, when Jarrett was working as Richie Daley's deputy chief of staff, and Michelle Robinson presented herself for a job. The bond the women struck was nearly instantaneous and soon extended to Michelle's fiancé. Barack now thought of Jarrett almost as a sibling. He had faith in her judgment, her intuitions, and her motives. Her desire to see him win was overwhelming, but she cared just as much about his remaining true to himself. Obama returned to the mainland to discover an unwelcome development. Just as he'd feared in February, Clinton was trying to encroach on his message. Over Labor Day weekend, Hillary and Bill had traveled together to New Hampshire and Iowa, rolling out a brand new slogan for her campaign, "The Change We Need." Up in Concord, on a stage set bearing a placard that read, "Change plus experience," Hillary intoned, "Some people think you should have to choose between change and experience. Well, with me, you don't have to choose." Softening her stance as a partisan warrior, she touted her record in the Senate as a bipartisan pragmatist. Out in Des Moines, she told audiences that her candidacy, too, was a history-making proposition, a chance to nominate a woman and thus break the last and biggest glass ceiling. The arrival of October brought more bad news. The ABC News Washington Post poll that put Obama 33 points behind Clinton nationally, followed by a Des Moines Register poll that put him third in Iowa, 7 points behind Hillary and one behind Edwards. The day the Register poll appeared in early October, Obama's National Finance Committee, comprising a couple hundred of the campaign's richest fundraisers, was gathered in Des Moines and in something close to open panic. Obama arrived that unseasonably cold Sunday afternoon and spoke to the bundlers, calming their nerves. But many were left still wondering if it was too late to stop Hillary, especially if Obama was unwilling to kneecap her. Obama wondered, too. The Iowa home stretch was drawing near, and he believed that on his present trajectory, he was headed for a respectable second place. "And I ain't running," he thought, "to be a respectable second." He needed a plan to change the dynamic. He needed a plan to change the game. 4 days after the Finance Committee meeting, Obama and his brain trust convened in the conference room of a law firm in downtown Chicago. The candidate opened the proceedings with a blunt and bracing statement. "I think everybody around the table would admit that we're losing right now." "I'm not going to yell," Obama went on. "Look, everybody here has worked extremely hard and done a very good job, no question about that. And we're in a position to win this thing. But the fact is, right now, we are losing. We've got 90 days to turn this around, and we're going to figure out in this room what we have to do to make sure we win. We're all on the same team here. Everybody's got to check their egos at the door. But we've got to be honest about where we're falling short and what we need to do to succeed." Obama raised an issue that had been bothering him for months, the change versus experience dichotomy. He'd always grasped the rationale behind homing in on transformation. He'd accepted, though not eagerly, the campaign's decision to make its slogan "Change We Can Believe In." It struck him as too pat, but he preferred it to the other option on the table, "United We Stand," which he rejected as sounding like an airline slogan. But Obama was reluctant simply to cede experience to Hillary. Being a state senator wasn't nothing, he said. He had a real record, had passed legislation, some of it important, such as ethics and death penalty reform in Springfield. He had more elected experience than Clinton, as a matter of fact. Like Obama, the pollsters in the room had been grappling with the issue all year long. Time and again, they would hear in their focus groups expressions of unease about Obama's greenness and his barren resume. "He's too new," people would say. "Why doesn't he wait 4 years? Why doesn't he just take the vice presidency? He doesn't know about foreign policy." But what was true when Obama's advisors met back in February was still true in October. Voters wanted change over experience by about a 2-to-1 margin. "Change is still the way to go," Benenson said. "Believe in the message. It's still right on." The problem now, Benenson observed, was that the campaign's polling showed Clinton making inroads with her new change-centric pitch. And though the national numbers may have been meaningless, she seemed to be gaining ground in Iowa. Everyone in the room understood from day one that they had to beat her there. The imperative was clear. The campaign had to prevent Hillary from swiping the mantle of change from Obama. Obama called on Axelrod to present a memo he'd prepared for the meeting. "There are three pillars to the kind of change voters want," Axelrod reminded them. "They're looking for a president who can bring the country together, who can reach beyond partisanship, and who'll be tough on special interests." Obama could embody that sort of change, but Hillary could not, Axelrod said. In fact, she could be painted as the embodiment of everything Americans despised about the Washington status quo. As Larry Grisolano, another Obama strategist, often put it, if Clinton wanted to tout her experience, they had to make her pay for her experience. Axelrod was a master of the dark arts of negative campaigning. The first major profile of him, 20 years earlier in Chicago Magazine, was titled Hatchet Man, The Rise of David Axelrod. Having worked on Clinton's Senate race in 2000, Axelrod had seen the focus group data that exposed her vulnerabilities, the apprehension among voters who thought of her as calculating, triangulating, slippery with the truth. Obama and Axelrod had agreed all along about Clinton fatigue, that it was bubbling out there just below the surface of her popularity and her husband's. The trick would be to incite it subtly, by implication and inference, to revive the voters' worst memories of the Clinton years without so much as mentioning her name, to eviscerate her without damaging Obama's reputation as an exponent of clean politics, to go negative, in other words, without seeming nasty. We will do this, Obama said, but he was adamant that certain ethical boundaries not be breached. A few months earlier, his campaign's opposition research department had prepared a memo linking Clinton's campaign contributions from Indian Americans to her husband's India-related investments and speaking fees. The headline on the document referred to her as Hillary Clinton Punjab. When the memo came out, Obama was angrier at his team than he'd been at any time during the campaign. Now he re-emphasized that such behavior was verboten. I told everybody at the start of this, he said, that I would not change who I am in this campaign, that I will come out the other side the same person I was on the way in. Don't any of you do anything that's going to embarrass me or make people think that I've changed who I am in order to win. If I ever catch anyone digging into the Clintons' personal lives, you will be fired. But I'm perfectly happy having a debate with her. I need to have a debate with her about who can actually change Washington, and that's the debate we should have. The plan was now set. The following month, Obama would be appearing with all the other candidates at the annual Jefferson Jackson dinner in Des Moines, and that would be the perfect place to unfurl the new strategy in earnest. There was precedent for the event providing a stage for a campaign relaunch. Gore and Kerry had come into the JJ on the ropes in Iowa and turned in revivifying performances. The campaign would pull out all the stops to turn the event into a display of its organizing muscle, and Obama would devote the time required to crafting a knockout address, an idea that instantly appealed to him. He thought of himself as a big game player, the kind of guy who rose to the occasion. He liked the pressure. He loved the spotlight. He reveled in the intensity of the moment. If the solution to a political problem was a speech, hoo boy, he was good to go. But the JJ was in November, more than a month away, too long to let the new approach to the Clintons sit dormant. Obama had been agitating to spend some more time with national reporters, and this seemed the moment to strike. He would accept a long-standing interview request from the New York Times as a way of setting up the next debate in Philadelphia at the end of October. Obama's communications wizards had determined that the media narrative that emerged from each debate was dictated by the first two questions and answers, and the easiest way to influence those questions in Philly was to have Obama take a few pokes at Hillary in the Times a day or two beforehand. Such catnip would be impossible for the moderators to resist. As Obama rose to leave the meeting, he brimmed with confidence again. "We're going to win this," he said brightly. All year long, he had been dancing around Clinton. Now he was ready to engage. He would bring many hidden advantages to this fight, not least the receptivity of the press to an anti-Clinton message. But he would also have one thing on his side that was plain for everyone to see. An ally of convenience whose determination to sink Hillary was every bit as great as, and even more rabid than, his own. Chapter 7. They love me! John Edwards never expected to be the third wheel in the 2008 campaign. The race was going to be Hillary versus him. That was how he saw it from the start. She would be the front runner, of course, he knew that. He wasn't naive. But as sure as night follows day, there would be an alternative, an anti-Hillary, and he would be it. And once he had her one-on-one, he was certain that he could take her. He thought she and her husband represented the arrogance wrought by power. He believed she lacked the common touch, had no feel for regular people, working people, which, needless to say, he possessed in abundance. He mocked Hillary in meetings with his advisors. There's Main Street's candidate. Obama, he didn't give all that much thought to, at least not at the start. Edwards came off the blocks much earlier than the other two, and his decision to run was free of the ambivalence they felt, the weighing of pros and cons, the doubts, the dark nights of the soul. Before the dust had settled on 2004, he was planning for 2008. On the day that Edwards and John Kerry conceded defeat to Bush and Dick Cheney, he discovered that his wife Elizabeth had breast cancer. A few days after that, he was on the phone with his pollster and close friend Harrison Hickman, gaming out the race 4 years hence, talking about tailoring his message to take on Clinton from the left. In early December, Edwards called his political team over to his place in Georgetown, the six-bedroom row house on P Street that he and Elizabeth had bought 2 years earlier for $3.8 million, to discuss how to spend the next couple of years in the optimal fashion. Having given up his Senate seat to run for president, Edwards was unemployed. He needed to beef up his foreign policy credentials, so he would make some trips abroad. He would court labor, schmooze donors, and nurture his connection to Iowa, where he had finished a surprising second in the 2004 caucuses. He also said he wanted to set up some kind of anti-poverty nonprofit. The plight of the poor wasn't a slam-dunk political winner, but Edwards declared that it was something he cared about, and his advisors knew it was no bad thing for a candidate to embrace what moved him. They also knew it would rhyme with the neo-populist stance he would strike in his challenge to Clinton. The pathway was clear to Edwards: beat Clinton in Iowa, survive New Hampshire, then kill her off in the South Carolina primary, which he carried in 2004. Over and over, he proclaimed to his aides, "I am going to be the next president of the United States." Some of them dismissed his outsized confidence as pro forma, but others took it as a sign of something deeper, a burgeoning megalomania. He was not the same guy who'd come out of nowhere and beaten the incumbent Republican Locke Faircloth to become the junior senator from North Carolina in 1998. Back then, everyone who encountered him was struck by how down-to-earth he seemed. He had fewer airs about him than most other wealthy trial lawyers, let alone most senators. He was the son of a textile mill worker, the first in his family to attend college, optimistic, cheerful, eager, and idealistic. The first time he met Hickman, the pollster asked Edwards, as he did every candidate whom he was considering working for, what one word his intimates would use to describe him. Most politicians said impatient, aggressive, or ambitious. Stretching the word with his southern drawl, Edwards said, "Nice." And it was true, disarmingly so. Some of his friends started noticing a change after he was nearly chosen by Al Gore to be his running mate in 2000. The sudden interest in superficial stuff to which he'd been oblivious before, from the labels on his clothes to the size of his entourage. But the real transformation occurred during the 2004 race. When Edwards caught fire in late 2003, he started getting a buzz from the larger crowds and lost interest in smaller rooms or individual meetings. "Why am I doing this trip? There's no big event," he griped to his schedulers. After emerging as Kerry's main challenger, he waged the most open, relentless campaign to get on the ticket of any potential VP in the modern era. That success swelled his head, and his experience during the general election seemed to inflate it to the point of bursting. He reveled in being inside the bubble, the Secret Service, the chartered jet, the press pack following him around, the swarm of factotums catering to his every whim, and the crowds, the ovations, the adoration. He ate it up. In the old days, when his aides asked how a rally had gone, he would roll his eyes and self-mockingly say, "Oh, they love me." Now he would bound down from the stage beaming and exclaim, without the slightest shred of irony, "They love me." The loss on election day and Elizabeth's diagnosis set him back on his heels. For a few months, he was closer to his old self again, but soon enough, what one of his aides called the ego monster returned. Once, Edwards had been warm and considerate with his staffers. Now he was disdainful, ignoring them, dismissing their ideas, demanding that they perform the most menial of tasks on his behalf. He made his schedulers find out what movies were available on different flights so he could decide which ones to take. He would fly only first class or on private planes he cadged from donors. At the same time, he started blowing off his most generous contributors, failing to return their phone calls and refusing to see them. As Edwards's mistreatment of his staff and supporters got worse through 2005, some of the people closest to him interceded, trying to set him straight. "You can't talk to people that way," Hickman scolded him after one off-putting display. "You didn't get any smarter just because you were on the national ticket," he went on. "People are attracted to the nice John Edwards, and for a lot of them, you're not that John Edwards anymore." Edwards bridled the criticism, disputing the idea that solicitousness was required to win. "Kerry didn't do any of that, and he got nominated," Edwards observed. Other times he reacted with anger. "I don't know where that's coming from," he said to Hickman at one point. "You have to consider the source," Edwards rationalized. "A lot of these people are hangers-on." One of the lessons that John and Elizabeth took away from 2004 was that they had relied too much on aides, advisors, and consultants. The political people hadn't helped Edwards. They'd hurt him, gotten in his way. If they just let John be John, he might have been president. Edwards had a phrase he used all the time to describe the problem, the Valley of Staff. In his next bid for the White House, he and Elizabeth agreed they would circumvent the handlers while John forged his own path. It wouldn't be a campaign at all in any conventional sense, they said. Instead, he would be a cause. The denizens of the Valley of Staff were astonished by the narcissism that seemed to have infused their candidate. Distraught and dispirited, too. But for a long time, they continued slaving in the service of the illusion at the core of Edwards's political appeal, that he remained the same humble, sunny, aw shucks, son of a mill worker he'd always been. The cognitive dissonance was enormous, sure, but they were used to that, because for years they'd been living with an even bigger lie, the lie of St. Elizabeth. Even before the cancer, she was among her husband's greatest political assets. In one of the focus groups conducted by Hickman in Edwards's Senate race, voters trashed him as a pretty boy shyster, until they saw pictures of Elizabeth, 4 years his senior. "I like that he's got a fat wife," one woman said. "I thought he'd be married to a Barbie or a cheerleader." The Edwards' eldest son, Wade, had been killed in a car crash in 1996. For a long time, Elizabeth went to his gravesite every day and read softly to the tombstone. She gave birth to their youngest daughter, Emma Claire, at age 49, and their son, Jack, at 50. The combination of her suffering, resilience, and imperfections made her a poignant figure, but it was the illness that elevated Elizabeth to a higher plane, rendering her iconic. She learned she might be sick on the Friday before Election Day in 2004. Her chemotherapy treatment started almost immediately. John was at her side throughout it, and everyone remarked on his warmth and attentiveness and on the closeness of their bond. She confronted her illness with bracing courage and wry humor, emerging quickly as one of the most outspoken and widely admired cancer survivors in history. By July, she was shopping a book proposal on her ordeal, and by October, she'd struck a deal. No one in the Edwards political circle felt anything less than complete sympathy for Elizabeth's plight, and yet the romance between her and the electorate struck them as ironic nonetheless, because their own relationships with her were so unpleasant, they felt like battered spouses. The nearly universal assessment among them was that there was no one on the national stage for whom the disparity between public image and private reality was vaster or more disturbing. What the world saw in Elizabeth, a valiant, determined, heroic everywoman, what the Edwards insiders saw, an abusive, intrusive, paranoid, condescending, crazy woman. With her husband, she could be intensely affectionate or brutally dismissive. At times subtly, at times blatantly, she was forever letting John know she regarded him as her intellectual inferior. The daughter of a Navy pilot, Elizabeth had lived in Japan when she was a girl and considered herself worldly. She called her spouse a hick in front of other people and derided his parents as rednecks. One time, when a friend asked if John had read a particular book, Elizabeth burst out laughing. "Oh, he doesn't read books," she said. "I'm the one who reads books." As far back as the 1998 senatorial campaign, She had been prone to irrational outbursts that perplexed and worried John's advisors. The first time Hickman witnessed this during that race, he attributed it to the strain of her being pregnant with Emma Clare and her lingering grief over Wade. But a close friend of the Edwardses from law school informed him otherwise. "She's always been this way," the friend said. "The sharp manner, the cutting comments, the sudden and inexplicable fulminations." During the 2004 race, Elizabeth badgered and berated John's advisors around the clock. She called Nick Baldick, his campaign manager, an idiot. She accused David Axelrod of lying to her and insisted he be stripped of the responsibility for making the campaign's TV ads. She would stay up late scouring the web, pulling down negative stories and blog items about her husband, forwarding them with vicious messages to the communications team. She routinely unleashed profanity-laced tirades on conference calls. "Why the fuck do you think I'd want to go sit outside a Walmart and hand out leaflets? I want to talk to persuadable voters," she snarled at the schedulers. Elizabeth's illness seemed at first to mellow her in the early months of 2005, but not for long. One day, she was on a conference call with the staffers of One America, the political action committee that was being turned into a vehicle for John's upcoming 2008 campaign. There were 40 or 50 people on the call, mostly kids in their 20s being paid next to nothing, and in some cases, literally nothing. Elizabeth had been cranky throughout the call, but at the end, she asked if her and her husband's personal health care coverage had been arranged. "Not yet," she was told. "There are complications. Let's discuss it after the call." Elizabeth was having none of that. She flew into a rage. "If this isn't dealt with by tomorrow, everyone's health care at the PAC will be cut off until it's fixed," she barked. "I don't care if nobody has health care until John and I do." The health care call immediately attained wide infamy in the Edwards' political orbit. The people around them marveled at Elizabeth's callousness. This from a woman whose family had multiple houses and a net worth in the tens of millions. They marveled as well at the tight-lippedness of their operation, the loyalty to John that kept any of the stories about the other side of Elizabeth from seeing the light of day. Yet no one called her out on it, least of all her husband. When she demeaned him, he pretended not to notice. When people complained about her behavior, he brushed them off. His default reflex was to mollify her or avoid her. No one doubted that, as her condition improved, the increase in John's travel had a lot to do with steering clear of his wife. The Regency Hotel on Park Avenue in Manhattan was the preeminent clubhouse outside Washington for Democratic politicians and those who loved and funded them. Its restaurant, 540 Park, served the city's most storied power breakfast, and its bar, the library, was a prime site of lubrication and transaction between supplicants and benefactors. The Regency was Edwards' hotel of choice when he was staying in New York. One early evening in February 2006, Edwards was hanging out in the bar, having a glass of wine with one of his donors and his young traveling aide, Josh Brumberger, when a woman sitting at a nearby table with some friends recognized him, walked over and introduced herself. "My friends insist you're John Edwards," Riel Hunter said. "I tell them no way, you're way too handsome." "No, ma'am, I'm John Edwards," the candidate replied. "No way, I don't believe you." Brumberger saw this kind of thing all the time. Women were always hitting on his boss. He and Edwards had a well-oiled system in place for dealing with these situations tactfully and politely. "He is John Edwards," Brumberger interjected, "and I'm sorry, but we're in the middle of something, thank you." "Oh, I'm sorry," Hunter said and retreated to her table. From the get-go, Brumberger thought that she was trouble. Everything about her screamed groupie. She looked like a hybrid of Stevie Nicks and Lucinda Williams in an outfit more suitable for a Grateful Dead concert than an evening at the Regency. A few minutes later, after Edwards departed for a dinner around the corner, Hunter came back over to Brumberger and started quizzing him on his job. "I think I can help you guys," she said, and handed him her business card. The inscription read, "Being is free. Riel Hunter, Truth Seeker." After Hunter left, Brumberger sat there chuckling, having another glass of wine with one of his colleagues from Team Edwards who had joined him. A little while later, he looked up through the window and clocked Hunter and one of her friends cornering his boss on his way back from dinner. "Holy shit, that crazy lady just cut him off," Brumberger yelped and sprinted outside, where he broke up the scene, leading Edwards back into the hotel. Thank you, Edward said, apparently relieved. I'm lucky you saw that, because those women, I don't think they would have quit. Brumberger would always wonder about that evening. Was Hunter's presence really an accident? Had she and Edwards met before? Did she slink into the hotel and spend the night with him after Brumberger went home to his New York apartment? Because a few months later, without warning, Hunter was back, in a big way. Get ready to get mic'd up, Edwards told Brumberger in June before a speech the candidate was set to deliver at the National Press Club. We're going to have a camera operator and a documentarian traveling with us, Edwards said. We're going to show the world what it's really like to be John Edwards. The idea was that Hunter would produce a series of web videos documenting life on the road with Edwards. Edwards told Baldick, now running his pack, that he liked the concept, that they should do it. Baldick objected for any number of reasons, but not because he had the slightest worry that Edwards was fooling around with Hunter. That was one thing the people in the Edwards sphere never stressed over when it came to John, who they believed had long ago made the decision not to fall into that trap. And anyway, he had always seemed, well, sort of asexual, at least to his staff. No, Baldick's concerns revolved around the way the project would feed the ego monster. Oh, great. A camera with you, he thought when Edwards raised the subject. This is going to be a really good idea. Baldick also quailed at the cost. The proposed budgets Hunter submitted ran into hundreds of thousands of dollars. For months, Baldick used the price tag as a reason to resist signing her contract. But Edwards kept poking at him, calling him weakly, saying, It'll be really cool. It'll be on the web. We've got to push the envelope. Eventually, a big check came in from one of Edwards' donors, and that gave John his trump card. Now Nick can't tell me no, he said to Brumberger triumphantly. By then, Hunter was already a constant presence on the road with Edwards. Who needed a contract? There was history to be made. All summer long and into the fall, she traveled with him everywhere, Pennsylvania, Texas, Iowa, Ohio, and New York, even on a trip to Africa, where they visited Uganda. Nothing about it was secretive. Her name was always on the flight manifests, and even Elizabeth's allies thought Hunter was legit, that Elizabeth had probably approved the project, given her fascination with the web. There was nothing legit, however, about Hunter's behavior. It was freaky, wildly inappropriate, and all too visible. She flirted outlandishly with every man she met. She spouted New Age babble, rambled on about astrology and reincarnation, and announced to people she had just met, I'm a witch. But mostly, she fixated on Edwards. She told him that he had the power to change the world, that the people will follow you. She told him that he could be as great a leader as Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr. She told him, you're so real, you just need to get your staff out of your way. She reinforced everything he already believed, told him everything he wanted to hear. Edward swooned, of course, gobbled up every word like so much pop-psych popcorn. He spent hours talking to her, listening patiently to her ideas about the state of American democracy and her advice on media strategy. She had intuitions about Chris Matthews. He ate every meal with her, sat next to her on the plane and in the car, offered to wheel her bags through airports. He told the staff to treat her like a principal. He behaved as if she were a combination of an advisor and a spouse. When Baldick suggested that she not take this or that trip, it's all me.